On the program today, paying your bills on time, grocery deliveries, whether you're home or not, and the truth behind those animals you see on screen. They are not, my friends, what they seem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 12th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is the thing about knowing what's going on in an economy, globally or otherwise. Sometimes you've got good, hard data, stuff you can dig into and figure out what's what. Other times, though, it's more amorphous. You've just kind of got to feel what's up. So what time do you think this is? Spoiler alert, it's the squishy time. The coronavirus is the big macroeconomic unknown right now. So Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going with some things to look for.
Already, we've seen delays in Apple's iPhone production. TV manufacturers are expected to slow down their assembly lines. Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners says coronavirus has the potential to disrupt the electronics supply chain.
It's everything, consoles, laptops, phones.
Some video game releases have been set back amid the outbreak. Analyst Ken Rumpf at Jefferies says China supplies a lot of video game development.
Intangible things like doing the artwork, doing the programming that's required, also have a supply chain.
Tourism is starting to see a hit as fewer Chinese citizens travel abroad. And some watchmakers have pulled out of a trade show in Basel, Switzerland because of concerns about the coronavirus. Big automakers like GM and Toyota have yet to restart operations in China. Dale Rogers is a professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. He says in recent years, China has grown more vital to global manufacturing.
You know, it's many times more important to global supply chains than it was at the beginning of the millennium.
It's still hard to quantify exactly how much the virus has cost the American economy. Minzi Chen at the University of Wisconsin says until more recent data are published,
we're probably going to be relying upon anecdotal evidence, informal surveys, and alternative indicators.
A report out this week from the shipping research company Sea Intelligence found that delays cost shipping companies $350 million a week in lost volume. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Anecdotal evidence and other alternative indicators. Squishy, right? Like I said. From the New York Federal Reserve this week, this item, the latest quarterly report on household debt. There is a lot of it. $14 trillion, the 22nd consecutive quarter of rising household debt in this country. One thing the Fed likes to keep an eye on is the number of people in what is called serious delinquency, 90 days past due on a bill. And in this economy, unemployment at historic lows, the longest expansion ever going on, two-thirds of past due debt falls into that serious delinquency category. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra looks at why that 90-day mark is so important.
A lot of people have paid a bill a month late.
At 30 days, it's a mistake. It's an oops. They were on vacation. They misplaced the bill.
But Chi-Chi Wu at the National Consumer Law Center says when you're 60 or 90 days late,
someone's in serious trouble. This is someone who's lost their job, got sick. They don't have the funds to pay.
And it's hard for people who owe several months' worth of loan payments to dig themselves out of this hole.
A bunch of late fees have piled on the previous month's payments. And so now you're looking at a much larger payment that you have to make.
So the 90-day mark has become a rule of thumb for lenders. Greg McBride is chief financial analyst at Bankrate.com.
By the time you get to the three-month mark, the chance that I'm going to pay you is, almost nil. So at that point, financial institutions are having to significantly write down the value of that particular asset, that loan.
90 days can be a turning point for mortgages in particular. Joanne Needleman, an attorney at Clark Hill, says when people are 3 months late on their mortgage payments,
that is a triggering kind of benchmark to start then doing outreach to consumers for possible loan modification.
It's also when banks start ramping up their foreclosure threats. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Wednesday, primary schmimary, more record highs at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As of our last notification this past Friday, unemployment in this economy, as I mentioned a minute ago, is running at a rate of 3.6%, which is very, very low. But even in a labor market as tight as this one, there are always people getting laid off. For them, there are unemployment benefits. But if you get laid off in Florida, unemployment is a good deal less beneficial than it used to be. It's among a handful of states that have cut back, paying lower benefits for less time to a smaller proportion of laid off workers than were covered a decade ago. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
Lori Skop is 45. She's a social worker at an agency in Miami, Florida that helps low-income families. 11 years ago, in 2009, Skop had just returned to work after recovering from a severe illness that had left her disabled for years.
And my first job ended with a layoff after 6 months from a nonprofit that had a federal contract. I had 4 hours notice.
As we sat in a Miami park near her office, Skop remembered. The Great Recession was raging. Unemployment in Florida topped 11%. And initially, Skop didn't qualify for unemployment benefits. She hadn't worked long enough. Meanwhile, she lost her apartment.
It's obviously very, very stressful. It's very taxing physically when you are moving from place to place and you are, you know, living on the edge, so to speak.
Eventually, she did qualify for unemployment, $600 a month. She got 6 months of state benefits and extended federal benefits when those ran out. Fast forward to 2014. Skop had a good job at a big university hospital. Her department was shut down, and she was laid off again. This time, her unemployment check was $470 a month, and the benefits ran out after just a few months.
You are reliant on that money for doing things to find another job, and I did. But I also needed those funds to meet very basic needs.
Florida has a long history of making it more difficult for particularly low-wage workers to get benefits.
Employment lawyer Arthur Rosenberg recently retired from Florida Legal Services. He says during the Great Recession, Florida was inundated with unemployment claims, and like many states, it had to borrow from the feds to pay benefits. To return the unemployment system to solvency, the legislature cut benefits and tightened eligibility. For instance, laid-off workers now have to apply for benefits and verify their job searches online.
Objectively, well, that seems fair. We're in the computer age. But when you're talking about a lot of people that have difficulty with English, low-wage workers that need help, that's going to keep a lot of people off the rolls.
Before the Great Recession, 30% of unemployed Floridians qualified for benefits. Today, just 10% do. And Florida is among a handful of states that have cut how long people can receive benefits, from 26 weeks to now just 12 weeks when unemployment in the state is low. And real estate appraiser Walter Carpenter says that's exactly how the system should function when the economy's strong. He chairs the National Federation of Independent Business in Florida.
If you're in full employment, there's a lot of job opportunities. You don't need to be paying benefits for as long of a period of time.
The taxes Florida employers pay to fund unemployment benefits are now the lowest allowed under federal law. And the program's been renamed Reemployment Assistance to emphasize the goal of getting people off benefits and back in a job quickly.
That's where I think that Florida's been very innovative. You know, the concentration is on reemployment or training sessions for people.
Though even with unemployment down to 3% in the state, it often takes people longer than 12 weeks to find a new job that fits their skills and experience. Florida now has one of the highest rates in the nation of unemployed people who exhaust their benefits before finding work again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So here's a query unique to these days of digital streaming. If an old song from like the vinyl days suddenly catches on and gets streamed a lot, does that make it a modern day hit? I ask in service of a song called Break My Stride, a one-hit wonder from almost 40 years ago that has gone viral on TikTok, the social media platform filled to overflowing with short videos. So again, does that streaming success make a song a hit? Because long gone are the days when simply counting up record sales gave you a sense of what songs were popular, right? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst has more. Last night I had
the strangest dream. Almost 800,000 TikTok users have posted goofy videos with Matthew Wilder's 1983 hit Break My Stride. They've been watched tens of millions of times. TikTok by itself won't get Wilder back on the Billboard chart. Billboard doesn't track the platform. NYU professor Larry Miller says Billboard does look at streaming, but it takes a lot of listens to equal one album sale. And that's the measurement that matters.
1,250 clicks from a paying subscriber or 3,750 clicks for a user on, say, the ad-supported tier.
Wilder's recent exposure has gotten him more listens on Spotify, but those charts can be gamed. Last month, Justin Bieber asked fans to stream his new record while they slept to drive up his ratings, which might not make much money for artists directly, says Michael Smith at Carnegie Mellon.
Artists get a fraction of a cent every time their song is streamed on Spotify. What they're hoping is that Spotify actually promotes the other things that do matter to them.
Things like touring. But the very nature of going viral is that it's short-lived. So by the time a one-hit wonder could organize a concert, people have moved on to the next TikTok trend. Music analyst Sherry Hu says there's a big gap between fans streaming and
recognizing the artist to the point where they want to, you know, go see the artist in person.
Viral hits only last a blink of an eye, and then you gotta keep on moving. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In Black Panther, while we went and scanned a rhinoceros for the movie, what we used on set was a big horse.
The secret's out, folks, and you heard it here first. But first, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 275 today, 0.9%, closed at 29,551. The NASDAQ up 87 points, also 0.9%. 97.25. The S&P 500, 21 points to the good, 0.6%. They're 33.79. Popsicles, Klondike, Good Humor Bars, all part of the conglomerate Unilever, which said today it will stop targeted ads at kids under 12, starting with ice cream. Unilever melted down 0.3%. Today, Lyft is still losing money, more than $2 billion last year. Uber's losing cash too, but says it should make a profit by the end of 2020. Lyft said it's going to take till 2021 for them. Shares down 10.1% for Lyft today. Uber basically flat. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The hard news about the coronavirus, or more officially COVID-19, as it has now been designated. We did a little bit of that up at the beginning of the program. Now the epidemiology of it. Actually, the epidemiology of the news of the virus, because it spreads, and fast, both actual information and bogus. Google and Twitter and Facebook and TikTok have all promised to prioritize fact-based information on the virus, and the World Health Organization says it is going to partner with tech companies to push out authoritative data. But as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, stopping the spread of fake news might be as challenging as stopping the virus itself.
If you were online when the virus story broke, you may have seen the bat video. This Chinese woman eating a whole bat went viral. Many comments suggesting, aha, this is what started it all. Well, it turns out that this was filmed outside of China in 2016. Internet giants like Facebook and Reddit say that their fact checkers are busy now, weeding out fake news on the virus. But mere humans are no match for what's out there, says Ben Oppenheim at the healthcare data science company Metabiota.
It's clear that the flood of data around this is of a scale that we need the tools that technology can offer just to help us get our hands around it.
One of these tools is artificial intelligence, where machines process data and learn to recognize what's important. AI can suss out which web pages tend to be accurate, which words tend to be sensational or panicky, which sources are considered authoritative.
So that when people are searching for information on social media sites about, you know, whether vaccines are safe or have side effects, they get routed to scientific authorities instead of purveyors of misinformation.
Sometimes it's easy to identify bad info, like hand dryers or ultraviolet lamps or sesame oil, quote, curing the virus, or contracting it from a letter from China.
Those kinds of links are easy to take down through machine learning.
Sarah Krepps is a professor of government and a technology fellow at Cornell, but she says there are risks too.
As soon as these companies do take more kind of interventionist measures, they're always raked over the coals by counterarguments that they're limiting free speech.
So how to balance good business with good public service? Well, at Google, she says,
one thing they have been known to do that there was some sense that they could do in this case is essentially bury links on page 4 of a Google search, which no one really goes beyond page 2.
We contacted Google, which pointed us to a policy of de-emphasizing, quote, lower quality results. Now, artificial intelligence can also emphasize authoritative science. At the website Buoy Health, users can get answers about the virus from an AI chatbot based on science from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Andrew Lay is CEO.
And it starts to piece, you know, really important details from your story, whether you've traveled to China recently, whether you've been around someone who's been confirmed as having a novel coronavirus. What symptoms do you have?
In the end, though, the people we talked to in AI and public health all said this stuff is really new. There are still lots of questions. What about people who don't trust the government or the World Health Organization? Who is the best digital influencer for an epidemic? Again, Ben Oppenheim at the data firm Metabiota.
So it's not just going to be pure technological solutions. It'll be maybe experiments that are run to try and figure out what kinds of messages and what kinds of messengers are going to really help settle people.
Which would help now. Metabiota's AI suggests that the fear quotient with this coronavirus is high and still rising. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Of the many things in this digital economy that make you go, I don't know, surely up there on that list is somebody going into your home, whether you're there or not, and dropping off your groceries. Not just dropping them off, but putting them away, too. But there is a market for everything, of course, and that is why last fall Walmart rolled out its in-home grocery delivery service, described as above, in the never-ending fight to stay ahead of Amazon and Whole Foods. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Kathleen Davis rode along on a delivery to see how it works.
Nick Burmaster is hauling boxes full of groceries out of one of Walmart's branded in-home cars. He's dressed in the company's blue delivery uniform. We're outside a house in suburban Pittsburgh. The customers aren't home, but their dog is.
All right, so this one says garage, fridge location garage, and then there is pets. That's why she picked the garage.
Burmaster puts surgical booties over his tennis shoes and turns on a small camera that's strapped to his chest. The camera is synced to the garage door lock through Walmart's in-home app. Burmaster has to turn it on before he can go inside. It live streams him putting those groceries where they belong. Milk and fresh food in the fridge, applesauce and paper plates in bags nearby. He turns the camera off when he's back outside.
It went perfect.
Right now, Walmart is offering in-home delivery in just 3 cities: Pittsburgh, Kansas City, and Vero Beach, Florida. The company won't say how many customers are using the service so far, but Whitney Pegdem with the in-home team says the company is happy with the results.
So I think a lot of the things that we're seeing now are really good teasers for what's to come, but also could shift pretty dramatically as we scale.
Walmart says it will expand the in-home program, but isn't sharing details about when or where that will be. Natalie Gott lives in a Pittsburgh suburb and has been an in-home customer since late last year. She has 2 kids and recently started working again, which doesn't leave a lot of time for grocery shopping. She says at first, she was hesitant to try a delivery service.
But the more we learned about it, there's a lot of safeguards to when, you know, people enter your home and they live stream the video. People are background checked. And so once I realized all those boxes were checked, the hesitation went away.
Now she uses it once a week. Groceries cost the same as in-store. Walmart charges customers $50 to install a smart lock on their doors, and an in-home membership is close to $20 per month, with the first month free. Gott says the cost of the service is worth the convenience.
It has cut down a lot on the impulse buying. So if I'm shopping in the store like normal, I would see something that's on sale or I'm hungry and something sounds good. So I don't do that as much because I'm just shopping on my phone and I'm just following my list.
Walmart isn't the only company that delivers groceries inside the home. Amazon launched Amazon Key in 2017, which also uses a smart lock system. It's currently available in 50 cities. Audrey Gusky is a consumer behavior expert at Duquesne University. She says companies need to convince customers that in-home delivery is safe.
You really need to gain the consumer's trust. And it is a hurdle for retailers to get over.
But Gusky says ultimately consumers want convenience.
Think back maybe a decade or two ago when we started shopping online and people are like, I'm never going to shop online because I'm afraid to put my credit card out there. But in reality, now it's just like second nature. So something like this, which seems very, not sure about it, a little bit concerned, over time, you know, your neighbors are doing it, your friends are doing it, your sister's doing it, and then everyone accepts it.
So Gusky says she expects other retailers will start offering in-home delivery to stay competitive. In Pittsburgh, I'm Kathleen Davis for Marketplace.
Technology is changing everything, of course, not just how we get our groceries, right? At the movies, for instance, we can see the changes on the screen. Thank you, CGI. But there is still a whole lot going on behind the scenes, as you will hear in today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name's Greg Tresson, and my wife and I, Caroline, we do commercial training and boarding for dogs, but we also provide animals for the film industry. We've been in business for 25 years now. Every year I tell Carol, I say, you know, I don't know how we can get more busy than this. And it always does. We have about 15 acres and we use every piece of this 15 acres because we've got a lot of animals, sheep, goats, deer, horses. Right now we're keeping a lot of rats. We've been doing a lot of work with rats, and it's appropriate. Here we are in the year of the rat. And I always like to say that rats, spelled backwards, is star. Technology, of course, is huge in the film business. We talk about it a lot because, you know, of course, there's the concern that somehow technology is going to take our job away. One of the common things that we see today in most of the high budget movies is they want to scan our animals. They walk us into a room that has about 180 cameras that are arranged in a circle around a pedestal so that they get every possible angle of that animal. Sometimes our character, the animal character, is altered. For instance, in Black Panther, the rhinoceros, while we went and scanned a rhinoceros for the movie, what we used on set was a big horse. If I was a primate guy, that all I did was handle chimps and apes and stuff, I literally would be out of business because CGI has taken that over. But for, you know, normal farmyard type animals and that nature, you know, we're still able to provide most of the action that's needed. Personally, you know, I'm 56 years old now. I don't need to do everything anymore. I just want to take care of the things that are really important to us and the big projects that come through that need our help.
Greg Tresson there in Ball Ground, Georgia. It's about an hour outside of Atlanta, I'm told. We cannot do this series without y'all, so hook us up. Would you go to marketplace.org? Let us know what is going on in your economy. This final note on the way out today from the Help Wanted files. I saw this in Fast Company. This summer, The Body Shop is going to become the first big retailer to use what's called open hiring. You meet the basic requirements, The job is yours, first come, first served. Quoting a company official here, we're not asking for your background check. We're not asking you to be drug screened. There are only three questions to get a job. It's, are you authorized to work in the U.S.? Can you stand for up to 8 hours? And can you lift over 50 pounds? I mean, it's interesting, right? All right, that's all we got. The Dow Industrial is up 275 points today, 0.9%. The NASDAQ up 87 points, also 0.9%. S&P 500, 21 points higher, 0.6% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Berger, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.